Hello, and welcome to The Musical Activist. I'm Sarah Nichols. I'm a pianist and composer, and I wanted to find out how, as a musician, I can respond to the headline that we've got 12 years to save the planet. On this journey, I'll be talking to experts and peers, climate scientists and other artists, and asking, what can I do and what can we all do? So, here goes. So today I'm sitting in my studio and I'm here with...
Fergus Partridge.
I've only just learnt your surname, that's really funny.
So I thought I'd step in there to help you out.
Well, I knew your name was Fergus, but I didn't know your surname was Partridge. There we go. So basically we met at a non-violent direct action training for Extinction Rebellion, 2 weeks before the October?
Most 2 weeks before,
So it was, late September 2019, and we'd obviously independently decided, maybe we should say why we were...
Yeah, because we didn't have that conversation.
No.
So
I basically went because it was advised that if you were going to be anywhere near the rebellion, that you should have this training, so that basically... I suppose I was thinking that it was to ensure that you didn't get in more trouble than you should. I don't know if you thought that.
Yeah. Actually, as it turns out, it was about how to get yourself in more trouble for the good of the movement, I think, you could argue. That's interesting you say that because, I come from a very similar psychology where I think I was going, if I'm going to do something like this, if I'm going to get involved in a protest, which is, disobedient and potentially law-breaking, then I need to do this as cautiously as possible. And that means doing all of the training that there is available. There's all these materials out there and I need to do all of that and kind of, make it safe because I'm naturally complex like this, but I have certainly a large part of me is resistant to risk taking and is cautious and just wants to be as prepared as possible. So we were both going into this non-violent direct action training hoping to be reassured.
Right.
Isn't that right?
Yeah.
We were kind of hoping to be reassured, get to see how it all works, get to see the mechanics of it.
Yeah, to make sure you were plugged into the kind of system. In the way
that's right, so you don't put a sort of foot wrong. And
we were quite surprised by how it went, weren't we?
Yes. Yeah. Because we met very briefly beforehand, didn't we?
Right,
we had a nice
chat,
about what we'd eaten that day. And you said something that really, affecting very early on, actually, where you had a brief chat and then you said, isn't it ridiculous that we have to be here?
Right.
I was really struck by that. Isn't it? Here we are doing non-violent direct action training in a youth centre in Brighton. And this way, both clearly, I think that point we sort of knew that maybe we were a little bit outside our comfort zones at that point.
Yeah, right.
And that we hadn't done this kind of thing before and we weren't, career protesters. But at the same time, what I liked about you, the way you said that, is that there was never any doubt that that was where we needed to be.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that. It's ridiculous we have to be here, but we do have to be here.
Yeah, this is the option.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that sort of summed it up for me.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I said it because obviously, as you say, I'm also not generally a law-breaking person, I'm not looking to be trouble.
No, I'm a good boy.
Pretty much fitting in, right. I mean, I like to challenge the bigger systems, I like to think differently about how we might move forward as a society.
Yeah, safely from afar.
Right, but I'm certainly not going to go out and smash a window or something.
No.
Certainly it just felt like it's so ridiculous that we have to even contemplate what this is, just because we care about trees and air and water.
And the future.
Like,
yeah.
The future, right, yeah. So, and the training sort of centered around, there was different exercises. I don't know, like I don't know if any of this is like secret, but I thought one of the interesting exercises was when we did the spectrum exercise. So basically we, as the people doing the training, were invited to stand from one end of the room to the other to measure where we thought the action sat on a kind of violent to non-violent spectrum.
Yes.
I thought that was a really interesting exercise because it showed that everyone's different and...
The spectrum was broad, wasn't it, as I remember?
Yeah.
It was far broader than you might expect. Yeah. And you had people, you know, quite a few people in the middle, but lots of people, you know, flat against one wall on one side and flat against the wall on the other. So
yeah.
They were really, really quite broad reactions to. Yeah.
And I did remember the, because we talked about the tube, and I and I stood on quite the violent end. And
as in you were saying that it was, you considered it to be a violent action to disrupt the tube.
Yeah. Right, and he happened to ask me, you know, why I'd stood there at that point. And I'd said, oh, because I think if you get trapped in a tunnel or if there's any kind of disruption, stations can get busy really quickly and it can get really stressful. And, you know, if people have breathing problems or claustrophobia or just are normal and feel stressed in a crowd underground, or anywhere, I mean, overground, you know, it's not a pleasant experience. And it was weird because when I said it, like, quite a lot of people came towards me. it's like, yeah, people going, oh, I see. So there was this sense that you could appraise an action from lots of different directions. There was plenty of people flat against the it's a non-violent wall because
yeah,
they were saying, well, you're not hurting anyone.
Yeah, you're not hurting anyone, but actually, just occurs to me while you're talking about that, I mean, how great that rather than just going straight into the, this is how you disrupt, they presented it as, here's an action that someone might do, how does everybody feel about that?
Yeah.
And showing that people feel differently, then reminding us that the police would also feel differently individually about that as individuals, and that the public will feel differently about that individually.
Yes.
And this reminder of everybody as being individuals and everybody being on that spectrum.
Yes.
And just sort of, it makes you mindful of it, doesn't it?
That's a very good thing to say, because so often we just have these like blanket feelings, don't we? Like if the media take a stance, then it feels like everyone's taken that stance, whereas
yes,
there'll be dissenting voices that aren't necessarily on the same platform.
Yes, and I think that's from what I've heard, you know, I'm not that familiar with these ideas, but in terms of trying to move the Overton window, it's it, in terms of people's...
The
Overton window is this idea that it's about what's acceptable to be discussed in the wider public at any time. So, for example, a few years ago, it wasn't really acceptable to discuss the climate crisis. It was just too terrifying and no one really wanted to engage with it, or they just didn't think it was that bad.
Yeah.
And a lot of what Exile's trying to do is actually move that window and the youth climate strikes. So that the centre, if you like, of what's acceptable to talk about gets shifted towards, you know, tell the truth. This is what's going on. We need to talk about how we can fix it.
Yeah.
And that quite extreme actions can potentially really help that Overton window move, as can, you know, fluffier actions. But you can't necessarily tell that easily at all from the way it's being reported how people's opinions are genuinely shifting.
Yeah.
Because you get these polarised, you know, the Guardian thinks it's all great, and the Daily Mail hates it.
Yeah.
You can't really tell from that the subtleties of how the Overton window is moving in and of itself.
I like that. The other thing that we did in the training was we learned how to like sit in a strong line or like we were asked to kind of design like barriers, weren't we, with our bodies?
Yeah, I and actually that was a, now you mention it, that was, I haven't really thought about that too much since. That again, I felt a bit adrift with, because I felt like, well, if we are going to be doing this and we are now going to go through, you know, being trying to work out how to successfully blockade a road now that we've decided that we're all definitely breaking the law and, you know, are arrestable, because that's sort of implicit in that.
Right.
Having done that, can you just tell me what the best way of doing it is rather than letting me try to work it out myself? But again, there was this kind of amazing freedom of you split it into different groups and try and, you know, work out what the best way of doing that is.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of felt like I wanted a bit of a cheat sheet that
right.
would kind of tell me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It was probably more engaging to try and work it out yourself.
Surely, yeah. I mean, that's the best way to learn, isn't it? Mm. If you're having to think. And presumably, maybe they also learn stuff, right, in observing. Because somebody might know something really incredible. But
yes, yeah. And there was some guidance afterwards, of course, as well, I think, yeah.
The conversation with the angry motorist was really interesting, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was quite easy to be the angry motorist, I guess.
It was! It was, wasn't it?
Because it's like, what are you doing? You're pushing me in my way. That's really out of order.
You know, I didn't cause all this. I didn't make all this happen. Yeah. What are you doing in my way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Part of the sort of methodology of dealing with that was a sort of educational part, right? You know, once you've kind of de-escalated, to try to get to something that for you summed up... you know, to communicate why you were there and why you were doing it.
I think in the first instance it was listening, wasn't it? So the idea is you don't immediately go in and shut them down and go, look, it's just really important, all right? Mm. You know, you kind of hear their objections and you empathise with them.
Mm.
And only when you feel that they've been listened to, then you can kind of go, all right, well, you know, this is why I'm here.
For me, I definitely felt like I wanted the cheat sheet at the kind of, what has worked in the past? Like, what do you find are really communicative facts? Because I know that I have some facts that have just stuck with me and I can't shake them off. But I don't know if that would work in that situation or whether it's just too abstract because I'm so inside the topic. Would you say it's fair to say that at the end of it, we both... although talking about it now makes it feel like probably we did learn things. At the time, it felt quite... It almost felt like we were sort of... I don't know, there was a kind of emptiness that didn't feel right, that didn't sit with the way that we felt about the topic, I suppose. I guess I missed any kind of discussion of actually climate and ecology, and it felt like we hadn't had space and time to just... Yeah, share our feelings, I suppose.
Okay, so that's interesting you say that, because before I engaged with XR at all, or the first time I did engage with XR and I went to one of their general meetings, I was expecting, I had this idea in my head, that we'd all sit around and we'd all talk about our feelings about the climate crisis and how awful it was and how we felt about it and how difficult it was to grieve. And, you know, we'd all sort of go around in a circle and there'd be this, everyone would have their sort of soliloquy about it and we'd all sort of come to terms with it essentially a therapy session. And of course that sort of thing does exist within XR, but I was sort of expecting to open with that. And instead, what I found, and this hasn't let up, I will say, since, is just this incredible sense of energy and urgency and almost that the fact you're here, you know, this stuff's bad.
Yeah.
And we just need to get on with it. Yeah. Right. So, you know, we'll have our check-in and we'll go around the circle and we'll have our thumbs up, thumbs down about how we're feeling. And we'll feel our feet on the ground at the end of the session and, you know, reconnect ourselves. But in the middle, we just got to get some stuff done. You know, there's a lot going on. There's a lot that needs to be done. And there was that sense of urgency. So I guess perhaps it was a continuation because I went to NVDA training after that first meeting.
Oh, did you?
So I've been to a general meeting. Which had you been to a general meeting before?
Yeah.
So I don't know if you found that same urgency of the meeting you went to. I went to another one that's quite different.
It was definitely very practical.
Yes, very practical. Exactly. It's pragmatic, wasn't it?
Yeah.
A lot of pragmatism. And there are grief circles you can go to do the grief circle thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think there's this sense of urgency in that. I've just found that's continued, really. And I suppose I see the NVDA training within that context. You know, you're here because you need to learn about non-violent direct action and the mechanics of that on the street. And no, there isn't time to talk about how you feel about the climate crisis. Yeah. Not in this session.
So the training perhaps trained us, but what did we do with it? So I didn't get arrested. I didn't do anything that was arrestable. What I did instead was try to be involved in running a stage. where there was brilliant talks and like panel discussions about how to talk to kids about climate change, and there was nice music.
You're a pell mell, right?
Yeah, so but it didn't last long.
No.
So after a couple of days, that site sort of collapsed. I think the families decided to go with the police suggestion of moving to Trafalgar Square.
I mean, did the police take your infrastructure? Is that not what happened?
I think they were going to, and so there was a kind of preemptive move to to avoid that.
I guess because in terms of it being a family area,
right,
you don't want the ugliness of lock-ons. I mean, I say the ugliness in that context of you know, people really entrenching themselves and holding out.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, it wasn't. It wouldn't have been appropriate to involve children in anything like a standoff. But yeah, what about you? Did you sort of apply the training in the end?
Yeah. So I went along on the Monday. So that was the first day of the action.
Yeah.
And you know, I was terrified. You know, I came off the train from Brussels. And, you know, I had a nice weekend in Brussels with my friend. And I came off the train and kind of went straight to the the action. And I didn't know what to expect. And I think we'd sort of texted each other a bit before going, Whitehall sounds a bit hot, you know. Do we want to be, I mean, that's what, you know, that's right outside, that's the centre of power. I mean, you know, couldn't we start in, I don't know, Ilford or somewhere, you know, just a bit further out. So I was quite nervous about that, much more nervous than anybody else in the affinity group that I was.
Involved. So you got into an affinity group. That's
Good. Yeah, absolutely last minuters
right.
of you know, affinity groups. Yeah. And we're all in the situation where none of us knew what we were going to do.
Okay.
And all very unprepared, you know, laggards. And that was the basis of our group. And what's really nice is it actually feels like it's turning into a quite a genuine, you know, well-bonded affinity group now.
Yeah,
so
right.
It's sort of from that basis. But so I mean, it's very easy for me to, I found the whole experience extremely emotional, if I'm honest, and it's very hard for me once I've started talking about it to stop talking about it or stay on track. So I'm going to try and bring myself back a bit. You asked me quite a specific question, which is, did you use your NVDA training?
Well, no, I'm totally interested in where your story goes, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I watched a video. I didn't go to this training, but I watched de-escalation training video.
Oh, yeah.
So
which is sort of making people feel less aggressive, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, I felt that video I perhaps used more than the NVDA training I went to, in terms of I was there. God, really, I've now interrupted myself for my own flow.
Where did you go?
I started off on the Monday. Went straight to Whitehall.
Did you?
The reason being that I was sending all these, you know, texts kind of prevaricating to the affinity group. We're turning up at different times and I was going, well, let's all try and meet somewhere, you know, I don't know, where Costa Coffee or something, and then we could all go in together, because you meant to go in together in an affinity group, you know, so been doing the careful thing. And then, you know, someone for the group just went, yeah, I'll be there at 10:30. I'll go straight to Whitehall. So that just kind of set that, you know, everyone's like meeting at Whitehall, where we were supposed to meet.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be clear.
Yeah.
You know, in the southeast. We're targeting Whitehall. That's where we were needed. You know, that's where they needed the bodies in the road.
Yeah.
So we did. I went straight there, and of course, immediately it was just such a nicer situation than I was expecting, and a lot of fear fell away very quickly.
Yeah, it was basically, what, several hundred people just sitting around chatting, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean,
and there wasn't much infrastructure, but there was just...
There wasn't at that point, no.
Like a good vibe, wasn't
there? Was a very good vibe. You know, there was some, the samba band was, you know, brilliant, and they were, you know, amazing for a long time, and until I think they were forced to disband. But yeah, there's an excellent vibe, you know, really kind of nice, welcoming, actually. The police were all pretty relaxed, you know. Everyone sort of, you know, but they kind of knew they were in for the long haul, and this is the beginning of it.
Yeah,
you know,
day one.
It was a very good atmosphere. Maybe I even texted you today and said, you know, kind of like, don't worry about coming to Whitehall. You know, it's fine.
Well, I did in the end.
Yeah, you did. You did. I heard in your podcast. Yeah. So it was nice. At the same time, I was aware that there were people locked on. You know, there were people that were sitting on the ground that were glued to the ground, and that had their arms in metal tubes, and that, you know, it wasn't just people standing around having a chat, and,
yes,
and you know, there was this stuff going on as well. And it wasn't always, I've noticed, it's not always visible, because a lot of the time those people necessarily are lying on the ground or sitting on the ground and other people are standing. So a lot of the time you literally don't see that level of entrenchment. Yeah. It's just there. You don't see the hardcore. Yeah, that's right. So we were there and it was a sort of, you know, festival atmosphere. And a lot of what I wanted to do when I went up, it was kind of fact-finding. I thought, what is this like exactly? Is it like a march, which I've been on before? Is it like a music festival? I know what that is, you know. I knew it wasn't either of those things.
Yeah.
But I knew it had elements of them both, but I didn't know what it was. Yeah. So I was wanting to find out, if you like. And I think at that point, it was more like a festival than it then felt to me later on, perhaps. But we were there for quite a while, and then we decided we wanted to have a little bit of a look around. We came down to your area, so we came down to Pall Mall, just a few of us from the group, and had a look around there, and we saw the stage there and all the sort of nice kid stuff going on and the t-shirt printing, and I got a t-shirt printed.
Cool.
And that was great, you know. And then we all sort of, almost simultaneously, we all sort of looked quite worried. Like, we were a bit worried about Whitehall. We were a bit worried. There was quite a big police presence there when we were last there, and it looked like it thinned out a bit. And we just suddenly felt like, well, yeah, we've got this emotional connection with that site.
Yeah.
And we just wanted to check that it was all right, you know. So we went back, and actually we were right. There was a problem going on. The police at that point had started removing infrastructure. So there was a gazebo, and we pretty much arrived as one of the gazebos that had been erected was being carried by the police and unceremonially dumped over the railing, you know.
Yeah.
Hilariously, by the cabinet officers. So it was just kind of dumped into the basement of the cabinet officers. And there was another gazebo that was still up. And I think they were... I'm not sure exactly what was going on in there. I think they were maybe, you know, selling or giving away organic vegetables. You know, there were some cushions in there that people were sitting on. Mm. It was... no one was making bombs or anything. You know, it was just some nice stuff going on in there. And the police were clearly coming back to do the same thing to that gazebo. And the protesters very naturally just encircled the gazebo peacefully. But like, yeah, we're just going to put our bodies around this gazebo. We're just going to go there. No one had to instruct anybody to do that. That's just what happened.
Right. And you did that.
And I did that, yeah. And then someone said to me in the crowd, someone turned to me and kind of went, "You got any glue?" I went, "Oh, sorry, mate, no, I haven't." He said, "Well, you just ask other people around you if you've got any glue." And then I kind of was aware that, you know, something was going on there. And then before I knew it, the, I think, you know, 60, 70-year-old woman that was giving away organic vegetables had superglued her hand to the leg of the gazebo so that the police couldn't take it away. And her friend had tied a scarf around her hand. And bless her, she'd done it in the rush, quite high up. So she wasn't really in a comfortable position. So she was kind of like kneeling,
right,
you know, or half standing. And and then I was just suddenly aware that there was this very strange situation where the gazebo was absolutely full of police. So this is just a normal garden gazebo.
The gazebo was full of police.
Yeah, so what happened is the police just kind of occupied the gazebo, like, we're going to take this is ours, but we can't right now because, you know, an old lady has zipped herself to it. So we're going to just occupy it. But not just occupy it. At first I thought they were just around the outside of it. And then I realised it was actually completely thick with them. It was like all the way to the middle. They were just standing like skittles inside this gazebo. It's absolutely so bizarre. And it was at that point that I, for the first time, I felt this energy change in the crowd. And the crowd suddenly realised that the police were surrounded and that there were more of them, a lot more. Like, you know, there were thousands of protesters than police. Even though the gazebo was full of police, we were strategically, we had surrounded them. You know, there was the very primal tribal thing, like, we quite literally got you surrounded. Even though you've sort of chosen to be there, we quite literally got you surrounded.
Yeah.
And... and there are more of us than there are of you.
Yeah.
And there was, and you've just taken our gazebo. You've just taken our stuff. You know, you've
you could have
you're
said, please,
you're attacking us. Yeah, essentially. And the samba band like went up in volume, and the chants, I think the chant was, it's like a, it's an old Reclaim the Streets chant, I think, which I think is has, you know, a big influence on the movement. And it was, you know, whose streets, our streets, whose planet, our planet. And it was possessive, you know, and I think it's a great chant. I think it's very much got its place. It was something like, that's our gazebo, you know, and you're trying to take it, and it's not okay. And we're powerful, and you're surrounded. And the energy went right up, and people were standing up, and they were kind of chanting at the police. So there's no violence at all.
Yeah.
But the energy was different. It had changed up a gear.
Yeah.
And
how did you feel?
At first, I felt that rush of power.
Right.
And of course, there's got to be, it's that's actually really important, I think, to acknowledge, because a lot of what XR is about for me is empowerment. You know, I've been worried about this stuff for years, at least 12 years, I've been, you know, absolutely cacking myself about this stuff. And right. I've just been traumatized by the lack of energy around it.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of watching the slow motion car crash take place, you know, and feeling disempowered about it and just not understanding why anyone isn't doing anything. You know, and I guess at some level, including myself. And then here we were, and we're on the streets, and we're taking action,
and we've
got power. Yeah, this is the moment, and we've got power. And there's the state. We've got this power suddenly, and it felt incredibly seductive, actually, and important in one sense. Yeah, no, that's good. You've got to acknowledge, yes, you know, we have got power in this situation. Yeah, and then I suddenly kind of felt, and I think it's because of the de-escalation video I saw. I sort of thought, this isn't quite right. You know, we need to take the edge off this. This needs to come down a bit. And I turned to someone near me and I said, I think this could be a dangerous situation. And I noticed someone, I think, maybe overheard me, or they were thinking themselves anyway. And they just took action. They snuck off and they just went to talk. I felt like they went to talk to the samba band.
Yeah.
And the samba band, I mean, that sounded great. You know, they were going for it. It sounded brilliant. And what I love about this, they didn't just stop playing. They just gradually, really gradually took it down. Really gradually took it down.
Devolved.
And then someone came out, I think it was actually someone from the de-escalation team, came out, and she just very good. She didn't even say anything. She just motioned with her hands, just lowered her hands for everyone to sit down. The samba band quietened down. We all sat down around the gazebo. And then someone, once the band had stopped, someone just started singing, like a lone voice, just started singing, you know, a sort of beautiful, grieful lament. And I'm feeling like goosebumps remembering it, because it was, you know, XR for me at its finest in terms of taking a situation where actually we had been aggressed by the state, by the police, and we had de-escalated that situation, you know, and that had happened kind of collectively. And now we're in a situation where we were still resisting. We were sitting around the gazebo, looking at the police, who frankly looked like lemons at that point, standing at the gazebo, you know, like they're about to be charged. And there we were, just sitting around them.
Because they don't, in their brief, presumably, and I'm taking a massive leap here, but wouldn't be the same level of creative license.
No.
Right?
No, I imagine not.
Their order, go and occupy the gazebo.
Well, they're a hierarchy, aren't they? Not a holocracy.
It wouldn't involve a kind of, oh, the energy's changed. Shall we sit down now? You know, like...
No, they can't respond to that. No, that's true. Yeah, they, in fact, they didn't respond. They just carried on doing what they were doing.
Which is why they looked a bit silly, because you were being human and feeling it.
It's a very good point. We were responding. Yeah.
Wow.
And then there was another, just to condemn it again, as to part of the same story. But
how did it play out?
How it played out. At some point it was carried on, and then some people started to stand up again, and it kind of felt like, you know, maybe the energy was rising again. And then, I just love these guys, and I love them particularly for having seen how they work on the streets. I was just aware that the crowd was parting, you know, behind me, and I looked over my shoulder, and the Red Rebels, gliding in.
Amazing.
And they wrapped themselves around the gazebo, so they put themselves between the police and the protesters.
Right.
And you know, the
were
way
they
that they
looking
are.
At the police or at the protesters?
So no, so they went, that's a good question. They actually went kind of around it, so they were flowing around it, so they weren't looking at either, so they weren't in opposition to either. They certainly didn't face up to the police. But one very nice moment for me was, first of all, it de-escalated everybody and people sat down and just wanted to watch the rebels, you know. And there was one guy, one policeman, that I was particularly worried about, actually, that he's a young guy and he just didn't look okay. He looked scared. He looked anxious. You know, I felt bad for him. I just felt bad for him. I thought, well, you're probably not into this. You know, there's probably, I don't know. I don't want to, you know, say what his opinions are, but he might have experienced that situation before of having thousands of people massively disapproving of what he was doing.
And I suppose if probably you are morally in that right. situation as a policeman, probably in a lot of other situations, then it might turn violent. It's perfectly easy that it can.
That's right. Well, he was also picking up on the energy, and as I said, there was a real energy, there was a real possibility that it could have done.
Or it was anger, but it wouldn't have gone violent, but it would have been angry. Yeah,
that's right. I said possibly without, you know, XR's extremely clear, non-violent, you know, principles and training. They came in, and there was one moment where I think, you know, the Red Rebels, of course, never talk. They don't. They're absolutely perfectly in character at all times and wonderful for it, you know. But I think one of them must have just out of the side of their mouth said something to this guy, because he just went from this kind of fearful look. He just laughed. He obviously said some joke. I was like, it's getting a bit hot out here or something, isn't it? Or just, there was some kind of diffusing thing, and this guy just kind of relaxed.
Ah.
And it was nice to see that, as well as the general thing that they were doing of calming down the situation, that someone had kind of seen that this guy was not having a great time.
Yeah.
And, you know...
It's very powerful stuff, isn't it?
Really powerful,
because it contains the solution, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
As well as facing the problem.
Yeah, XR is the solution. Yeah, that's true.
So that sounds like an amazing experience. Did you want to say anything else about when you were up there? Were there any other moments?
Interesting
then also to sort of talk about the whole thing and afterwards as well. Go on.
Yes, and you know, this is I mean, I could talk all day about this. Unfortunately, I hope you got a big SD card. because that was the first day that I was up, and our group, our affinity group, our stated objective was to go up on the Monday and see what was going on.
Yes.
But we couldn't really see past that. And I hadn't really scheduled with myself. As I said, I wanted to find out whether it was a music festival, whether it was a march, what it was. And then next time I would be more involved, you know. But it was too late. It's too late by then. I was emotionally utterly involved with what was going on the street and, you know, ideologically and in every other way. So I had a day supposedly of working on the Tuesday, and I didn't get any work done. There was no point me being, you know, at home trying to get any work done. I was just on the Telegram channels continuously, on social media, on the Guardian website, just checking it, you know, furtively all the time.
Yeah.
So and then there was a Telegram message, because I was on all these, groups and channels that were sort of organisational channels that were keeping people in touch as to what was going on, what was needed. And a call went out, and it went out in the morning on the Wednesday. We're losing Whitehall. We need people. We need people to come up. And despite the fact that we were a Monday only group, suddenly eight of us were on the train.
Right.
Just heading up.
Nice.
You know. It was the day that they... So what happened is, I was expecting, continuously that week, whenever I got involved, whenever I checked social media, whatever, I was always expecting Whitehall to have been lost. You know, the whole time there was this threat, we're about to lose Whitehall, we're about to lose Whitehall, it's being taken, we need people, we're about to lose it. And we didn't, like for 4 days we held Whitehall.
Was it Thursday night that it eventually...
I think it was, yeah. Right. Thursday night, so full days, And, this is Whitehall we're talking about. This is the centre of power in this country. Yeah. You know, it's absolutely...
Yeah, for anyone that doesn't know, it's where Downing Street is.
It's where Downing Street is, exactly, yeah. And so... Yeah, so went up there expecting it to have all been cleared by the time we got there. And actually, we were sort of going to head to the Horse Guards Parade because we heard there were still some people there and there's lots of fallback to that area. got up there and the road was actually, they were still quite full of people.
Yeah.
Quite full of people. And
there was loads of infrastructure.
There was some infrastructure there. And there were loads of baby buggies because there was the, you know, the mass, nursing. You know, it's a nursing of the you know, of babies, which is extremely powerful. So we got there and, and literally baby buggies were blocking the road, you know, never mind about lock-ons and all that stuff. It was just full of buggies.
Yeah.
And there were loads of people there. There were loads of people there. And we watched as the police laboriously were unsticking people that had glued themselves to the road,
right,
and lock-ons, and you know, there was a circle of us sort of around the people that were on the road in that way, supporting them, if you like, and every time someone got you know, removed and carried away and arrested, people would, you know, offer their support and cheer and say we love you, and you know, would say nice things about the police as well. And at some point, it got down to the last person being removed, and a few of the people that I was with in my affinity group said, well, look, there's a group of people just sort of in solidarity sitting down behind them, even though the road's about to be cleared. They're sitting down in solidarity just a bit, you know, a couple of metres further down the road. So maybe we'll just go and do that and sit down, you know, sit down with them and offer our support, you know, put our bodies on the road. And so we did that, and we went and sat down. And it's only actually when I went to sit down that I realised, oh, hang about, yeah, it's...
This is the situation.
This is the situation.
Right.
And that guy over there was actually, you know, got his arm in a rucksack that someone else has also got their arm in, and they're locking on. And that guy's actually got his hand on the road and he can't move that. And that this is what's happening here, is that the police are removing these people, but while they're removing them, these people are locking on,
right.
And apparently someone was saying to me, yeah, it's taken them 5 hours to move 5 meters down the road
that. Yeah, because people kept getting replaced, yeah.
And I saw the mechanic. I was actually sitting in the middle of the machinery of that and I watched how that happened, you know. And of course, sitting down, I sat down in a circle with some of the affinity group members, and then it became very clear that a lot of people, like maybe half, I don't know if that's a true estimate, but maybe a third of the people were locking on and were in an arrestable situation. And yeah, so...
What went through your mind then?
Well, actually, if I'm honest, what went through my mind is I'm in the right place.
Right.
Yeah.
There we go. Yeah. The training worked.
Yeah, the training worked. And it did work. It did prepare me for that.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't surprised. Well, I was surprised.
Yeah, because the training was absolutely about that intense moment.
It was about that intense moment, yeah. And suddenly, me having, you know, over-prepared in terms of having bust cards on me, and I'd written all the, you know, solicitors' names on my arm in marker pen and all that, that all felt like, well, yeah, good thing I have. Right. You know, my over-preparedness, well, maybe it was just preparedness. You know, it's fine.
Yeah.
At some point, yeah, I think an XR... I don't know if they're a legal observer. I forget the exact capacity, but an XR guy came over, you know, in a high visibility shirt, and they're saying, "Any arrestables here?" And I kind of went, "I'm not arrestable, but I'm, you know, just, you know, offering my support, I think." And I was chatting to, actually at one point, I was chatting to a guy that was next to me that was locked on, and I think he was asking for some water or something, if someone had something, and I had a quick chat with him. And as I turned back, I came in halfway on a conversation where someone in our group was going, "Yeah, I mean, I'm just not just here to be a tourist." And I kind of chipped in and went, "Yeah, no, that's how I feel. You know, like, I don't want to just be a tourist about this." And then I kind of felt absolutely daft because I realised that what they were saying is they were
thinking about really getting arrested. That,
yeah, that's right. It's like a different level of commitment entirely.
Yes.
And, you know, I sort of watched, I would say, her make this decision to get arrested.
Yeah.
And it was, and I think some people will have, you know, very mixed feelings about this, but it was, I could see how she would feel like it was the right time to do that, because it felt like a very supported situation. You know, the police were behaving well. They weren't being overly aggressive.
Yeah.
There were legal observers there. You know, you felt very supported by XR.
And it was organic, right?
And it was organic, and, you know, everyone was being nice to each other. There was a band, you know, it wasn't the full Samba band, but there was sort of music playing. And, you know, as she said, you know, I want to do this. And I said, yeah, are you sure? And she said, look, I work in, I forget what it was exactly, but I work in, you know, for an environmental company.
Right.
And, you know, it's a badge of honour for me. Like, you know, don't worry about that, you know. Mm. I want to do this. But it was funny at that point, because I suppose what came home to me is that, I was really prepared for all this stuff to happen. And I had all these bus cards and everything, but I wasn't having any intention of getting arrested.
So
but suddenly, in her mind, she's going, oh, so what do I do now that I've decided to get arrested? And there was this sort of very quick conversation that had to happen about, you know, do I give my phone away? Do you take my phone? Should I keep my phone? What about my bag? You know, you're going to have my bag. Yeah. And, so and that conversation had to happen very quickly. Who's going to call, you know, your husband? What about the kind of contact details? And actually, someone from XR came over and sort of came into this conversation and said, okay, well, you will be her anchor, to me, that is. So, you know, you can contact her family. I will find out the number of the arresting police officer and the police station she's been taken to, and then we'll liaise. And again, there was this sort of amazing network of support that sort of arose around that. And then the police came over and they issued us with our 2-minute warning, essentially. So if you don't want to be arrested, you know, get out of here. And it all suddenly feel like that happened very quickly, you know. And so, yeah, the those of us, you know, that weren't prepared to get arrested, we stood back, you know, we said, you know, well done, and like, thanks so much, and yeah, stood back. And, yeah, watched the process for getting arrested.
Standing back, did you feel fine? Did it feel like the right...
Well, I felt like the right thing to do, but I felt like, fortunately, because I've been charged with this duty of being the anchor, I felt like it was in some way important for me not to be arrested. Yes. So that was quite a nice license for me emotionally, not to, you know, feel like I was doing the wrong thing. I would say generally that day, that whole day and that whole moment, certainly from that moment onwards, and waiting for her to get arrested and how long that took, which is, of course, the point. I mean, I can't bemoan that. The idea was this stuff took a long time to happen. Yeah. And sort of waiting for that to happen and then that happening, I was just very close to tears all day. Oh. I was in a heightened state of emotion all day, never quite reaching that point of actually crying and you know, being, never quite getting that catharsis, if you like.
Yeah.
But just, for me, it was just seeing just the levels of sacrifice that people were making, ordinary people were making, was just utterly compelling.
Yeah.
And I will say, like, transformative for me. That was the thing that I think that I couldn't imagine. I could imagine the music festival. I could, you know, I could imagine the march. You can't imagine the sacrifice until you see it. And it's the sacrifice, actually, that has been really belittled by the media. Mm. You know, there's no posh kids with too much time on their hand, going to get a job. And actually, I can see why you might feel the need to belittle it, because it's so powerful.
Right.
And has the potential to be so transformative when you're actually in there and you're witnessing it. And so, yeah, that day was the most significant for me because of that. And I feel very emotional talking about it, and I do whenever I talk about it. I think it was that point, I came home and I said to my wife, you know, can I get arrested? And she went, we talked about it, and we kind of went, well, no, it's not the right time. You can't, you know, we've got baby twins at home. We haven't got the care sorted out.
Mm.
But I think, you know, the idea was, well, down the line, you know, for next time, where there is the possibility of us being a bit more prepared, that might be the appropriate thing for me to do.
So when you think about, because you mentioned already being it doing your head in for 12 years already, I really want to ask quickly what the sort of starting point of that was. Can you remember, like, new stuff?
Yeah, for me it was I was taken to see a film called The Age of Stupid.
Oh yeah, Franny Armstrong.
Yeah, by Franny Armstrong. And it was the first time, I suppose, that I'd sat down in front of something for an hour and a half that was just about the climate crisis, that you couldn't look away from, if you like. There wasn't just an article that was quite easy to dismiss, or a headline that's quite easy to dismiss.
Yes.
And, yeah, I came out of that and, you know, my wife and I sort of went, well, you know, let's not fly anymore. And we sort of made that decision, just like, it doesn't feel right to be doing that anymore.
Yeah.
And yeah, I would say that it was from that point, I that was in one sense the awakening, if you like, in terms of the fear aspect of it.
Yeah.
And the mobilization in terms of making personal decisions about it. But I feel like personally, I didn't have the psychology straight of being able to, personally, this is as well, of being in a situation where I was able to effectively engage with the issue. There wasn't a group like XR either. There wasn't something that allowed me to engage with it in a wider sense.
Did you sort of sign up to political things or do petitions or, you know, because
No, I didn't.
So you were kind of holding it.
I was holding it. And what I did is I spent way too long on kind of, Guardian comments sections, you know, just in this sort of quagmire of people that really angrily were resisting that change and me sort of putting myself out there going, but you know, we're going to be in loads of trouble if we don't do something.
Right.
And just all I felt was this sort of tidal wave of resistance.
So you were like a lone voice in a...
That's how I felt, yeah. And that's a very important thing for XR for me, is that I don't feel alone.
So you didn't like join the Green Party or...
No, I didn't do anything effective like that.
Friends of the Earth. Okay. That's interesting.
I don't think personally I was in a situation, personally, emotionally, psychologically, where I was quite able to do that, actually.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so in a way, actually, there's a kind of signpost for you that's gone pretty much from the age of stupid straight to XR, in a sense. That's been your first opportunity to kind of go, right, I see that anyone can fit into this and I just need to find my way to fit into it.
Yeah, I mean, I did it until sort of like a couple, well, it's actually about a year ago, I suppose. I became vegan a year ago and I was still doing the individual stuff, you know, the personal stuff, trying to be the change. You know, and it's funny that people quote Gandhi on that, be the change, you know, you want to see in the world.
Yeah.
Because that's only half of it, isn't it? Because Gandhi did sit in the street.
Yeah.
Gandhi did absolutely non-violently resist the British Empire. So it's not enough just to be the change.
Well, this is it. I thought Rupert Reed's comment, response in Question Time, when the woman said, oh, you know, there's plenty of other ways to protest, and, you know, and he's like, I am all ears.
Yeah.
If you've got the way that we can get this through, please tell me.
That we haven't been trying for the last 30 years.
Exactly.
Then please tell us.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I thought that was a good response.
Yeah.
I'm totally excited by your story because, you know, when we met after the training, I think we were both, I mean, I don't want to speak for you, but I feel like we resonated and my feeling was kind of, oh, this is really intense and a bit sort of nasty and I don't want to be kind of, you know, bad.
I was absolutely with you on that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it's really interesting that actually for you what worked, what kind of lit the fire, if you like, was actually the total togetherness of it and the sort of ridiculous situation of the gazebo.
Yeah.
Like all these police defending a gazebo and, you know, and it comes down to something so
silly. There was an absurdity about it.
Absurdity, right. So we've probably only got like a couple of minutes left. Since the whole action has ended and in the sort of couple of weeks, is there anything that you've just generally thought, like, oh, I hope this happens more, or oh, I hope that doesn't happen again, or, you know, are there any sort of quick, like, summary things?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, tube action.
That was a shame, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a shame. That was a shame. So, you know, I hope that doesn't happen again, specifically... what felt like the targeting of an ethnic minority working class area. You know, that wasn't Whitehall.
Public transport,
electric train. I mean, how many boxes can you not tick?
Yeah.
Do you know,
it's very interesting because I realised that it's the same guy who did that action as did the Treasury one about 5 days before.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
The one where they tried to spray the stuff and missed, basically.
Right,
so
yeah.
That was quite interesting.
I mean, you know, at the same time, I do need to say, like, the level of commitment and dedication
and sacrifice
yeah.
that those people are prepared to make, I'm utterly in awe of.
Yeah.
It was just a case of the messaging for me.
Yeah, yeah, the place.
The place, you know, that's right. And that's part of the frustration. Like, oh, take that incredible will.
Like bravery.
And bravery and, you know, do that over here instead.
Yeah.
Do that in this way. But I've come to terms with that a bit more. I mean, I was furious, quite frankly.
I think loads of people were furious, yeah. I think a lot of people felt, hang on, I've just gone through hell for this, and yeah.
I didn't. If I'm honest, I didn't want to look at the XL logo for a couple of days after. I couldn't even look at it. I was absolutely
such a shame. The timing as well, because on the I think later that day or the next day they had the professionals for XL, which was really interesting, and they had the banners. And yeah, a lot of things, kind of really great actions, kind of got lost, didn't they?
Yes.
But and the sort of moral high ground. One on Wednesday.
Absolutely, with the police ban. That
ban, and then everyone went to Trafalgar Square. It was like
the more, and it turns out now legal high ground.
Yeah, total legal high ground. Every high ground.
So I went up to Trafalgar Square as well. So
right, did you on that Wednesday?
Yeah, on that Wednesday. Amazing. So I'd come from that, and actually I'd been very active, you know, on the Telegram groups and whatnot, trying to prevent the tube action from going ahead.
Yes.
And I really felt like at that point. On the Wednesday evening, that was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I felt like, it's okay, I can back off now. I've kind of contacted everyone I possibly can about it.
Yeah.
You know, I've done what I can. There's been a poll. Yeah. Everyone's against it. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's why I was so upset when I woke up on Thursday morning and it had already happened and it was worse than I was expecting it was going to be. Yeah. So that felt very difficult, yeah.
I suppose I'm really so thinking about, I mean, we've actually gathered, you were holding a guitar.
Yeah.
Which you've been holding the whole time.
I'm clutching it as some kind of protection.
And I'm sorry, because I turned the heating off, so it's actually a bit cold in here now. We're going to have a go at like starting to write some songs, which feels like a really nice, positive thing to try and do. And certainly, I think my brain still goes for the culture area, because I suppose that's what I feel like I can cope with, and maybe where I feel like I can amplify my impact a bit better. But I suppose what feels so important to me is the message, right?
Yes,
because in a way, you know, we can have an entire conversation about the method, but actually the message, right? And like, just how does the protest carry the message most effectively?
Absolutely.
That's my question.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's see if we can
get that straight.
Excellent. Thank you. I'm going to say thanks for chatting to me.
My pleasure.
So one of the things that we learnt in the NVDA training was about going floppy. You'll probably have seen it on the TV where protesters are being picked up by the police and being carried. And the idea is that if you're floppy, it would take 4 police to lift you rather than 2, because they're not, or maybe 2 if you're light. But anyway, more police than if you're just walking to be arrested, using up more time so that the protests can last for longer and impact the public mind more. So Fergus actually, after the training, wrote this song about the floppy carry.
My arms, hold my feet as you carry me down Oxford Street. We'll never be this close again as when you carried me past Debenhams. We're all trained to do this well, to not hurt each other, though not to help. Like distant brothers, like troubled friends, we're all in this to the end. Now you're taking me to a pearly sound, while you're holding me, carrying me well, because we're all in this until the end. While you're holding me, carrying me well, because we're all in this until it ends. While you're holding me, carrying me well. My body's yours, take me to myself, while you carry me well.